This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell, joining you until 12 o'clock this afternoon. Brahma's in the studio as well, keeping up the positive vibes. But before we go any further, a huge thank you to Matt for the news, and also, of course, to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. Always such a great start to your working week with Jeff bringing you all the views for your Monday morning. But of course, On The Record will be back tomorrow and every weekday here on RTR FM from 9 in the AM. As I said, and if you're a regular listener to RTR, as you should know, this is the Indie Media Show. It's all the interviews and views from the open publishing wires of the internet. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about quite a sort of, I guess, exciting action that's happening at the moment in Sydney. I'm talking about Blockade Australia's Sydney mobilisation. They've begun today by blocking the Harbour Tunnel and immobilising intersections throughout the city to resist climate destruction. We've previously spoken to Blockade Australia about 6 months ago when they were taking action to disrupt the Newcastle Coalport and rail line up there, but we're going to be chatting to them in a little bit to find out what's happening in Sydney at the moment. And also, there was some significant raids on Blockade Australia activists, with many people arrested, and a significant amount of sort of police intimidation used to try and to stop this this week of action that has just begun now. So a little later on the show, we're going to be catching up with them. We're also going to be taking a bit of a deep dive into the issue of the occupied territories and Palestine. According to the UNCEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, at least 13 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces so far this year. Dozens more Palestinian civilians have also been killed, including the revered Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abdul Akle. Yet, most of this has not been covered at all in the Western press, and there's very little, I guess, in terms of the coverage of the ongoing resistance to the occupation. So a little later on the program, we're going to be taking us quite an in-depth look into what it means to be a member of the Palestinian community, and what it means to sort of, I guess, have this experience of being a part of that diaspora while the occupation is ongoing. Alex is going to be catching up with Amir, Samia and Ayam, who are three members of the Palestinian community of WA. So a lot of reasons to keep it locked to RTR this morning.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you're a regular listener to this program, you would recall that approximately 6 months ago, we spoke to the folks at Blockade Australia when they were engaged in some direct action around the Newcastle, coal port and an industry up there. They're back taking action again at a convergence in Sydney. Blockade Australia has begun its Sydney mobilisation to resist climate destruction, and with groups disrupting intersections throughout the city over there in the East Coast. On the line now, we have Hayden from Blockade Australia. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Hayden.
Thanks for having me, mate.
Now, I guess a lot has been happening since we last spoke to you guys, and we'll get into that shortly. But can I just start by asking what's occurred today? I believe someone has locked themselves onto a vehicle to disrupt the tunnel, the harbour tunnel, and there's also been some other actions. Can you just start by talking us through what's going on today at this, the first day of this mobilisation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This morning, a young woman from Lismore had locked herself onto a vehicle blockading the harbour tunnel, and simultaneously there were quite large groups of people moving through the city in a disruptive manner, shutting down the roads, and, a similarly sized police mobilisation. But it was a few hours of quite significant disruption this morning.
Indeed, and I guess, you know, for people who aren't familiar with Blockade Australia, this this convergence has come about after, I guess, much planning and other actions and mobilizations, and, you know, a lot of people who have previously been involved in climate activism for some time. And I guess it's quite clearly, I guess, about trying to bring to light the urgency around taking action on for the climate and to stop the sort of the catastrophic climate change. However, I guess there's some people who think, well, we've just, you know, we've had a federal election, we've got this new ALP government that have made all these promises. Supposedly, it was a climate election with a lot of these teals being elected on climate issues. You know, perhaps we should just wait to see what this government does. I mean, did that at all impact on the plans for this convergence or for the organisers? Is, you know, this new ALP government pretty much business as usual, and you know, it really, you don't see anything changing whatsoever?
Look, I think it's certainly business as usual. You know, the idea that this has been a climate election is, in my view, a bit of a furphy. Certainly the sentiment of the Australian people has been that climate action is needed, but I think if you look at the actions of the incoming government, you know, there's little meaningful change in that regard. And I think the position that we're really advancing in is that meaningful change against kind of climate destruction isn't going to come from federal elections. It's not going to come from electoral politics, because the Australian system is one that is inherently destructive. It's built on exploitation, and it needs deep-seated radical change to have any kind of halt in climate destruction.
Certainly, we did see that with Albanese. One of the first things he did when he came over to WA was pledging his support for the Scarborough gas hub here. So, you know, very much speaks, I guess, volumes to the extent at which, you know, this federal government is going to act on climate change. I guess, you know, talking about the actions that have taken place today, have you received, I guess, a lot of support? Are there a lot of people who have come to converge on Sydney? And, you know, I imagine actions are ongoing. But do you feel like there is that groundswell, as you said earlier, that, you know, this was very much for the public, it was a climate election, but has that translated to more people wanting to be engaging in direct action?
Look, I think it has. I think there is, as you say, we can look at Beetaloo, we can look at Scarborough and see that, you know, the federal government isn't listening to people, what people are saying. And so there is an awareness that what's needed is for us to come together and act directly. I think there is a groundswell of people increasing in that regard. And over the last week, the solidarity that we've had come pouring in from all across the continent and across various sectors, I think likewise speaks to that.
Now, I guess talking about that solidarity, it would be remiss of us not to mention the significant, I guess, repression that has occurred with the raids on the, I guess, a property that many Blockade Australia people were staying at. Can you tell us exactly what happened in regard to the police raids? And I guess, you know, why do you think the police are sort of taking these actions against Blockade Australia activists?
Right, so in the last week we've seen a fairly unprecedented scale of police repression, particularly of climate activists on this continent. We've experienced quite severe surveillance, you know, an immense budget behind it. We've had two raids in the last week, the first of which was, as far as we can tell at this stage, completely legally unjustified. There's really no basis for it whatsoever, and, you know, that will, I think, increasingly come to light. You know, the question on many of our minds is, why is this repression so severe, right, compared to so many other groups that are, you know, quite vocally violent, for instance, you know, far-right groups that receive nothing like this kind of repression. And I think the reason for that is fairly obvious, is that there's a recognition amongst the Australian, you know, systems of governance that what we're doing, the ideas that we're advocating, are a far greater threat to the embedded power structures of this continent. They pose more of an existential threat. And so in that regard, while the repression we've been experiencing it's frightening, it's unpleasant, but it's not unexpected at all. The reality is, I think, that this is what happens when you get a violent and exploitative system into a corner, when you start genuinely challenging it.
And I guess looking at that, in terms of the climate movement or climate justice movement, and especially in a country like Australia, for I guess the vast majority of that movement is still very much, you know, intertwined within sort of electoral politics or within the non-government sector. And, you know, for those of us that have been either participating or at least paying attention to this movement over the last really sort of 15, 20 years, it's very much been a movement of, you know, attempting to elect people such as, you know, more progressive governments. And there was obviously a lot of hope around the Obama administration in the US, or more recently here, I guess, in our federal election, as we mentioned, with the Teals and the Independents. I guess, you know, in terms of a radical critique, if we look at the sort of the climatic situation in the world, and you look at sort of reports such as the IPCC's report, and, you know, there's clearly an urgent need for action to, I guess, confront the fossil fuels industry, and yet we still have the vast majority of environmentalists and, I'd say, you know, people on the so-called left are still very much embedded within the, you know, the institutions and the power structures that arguably are, you know, perpetuating the climate crisis. You know, I guess looking at it from that kind of radical perspective, how do you think the actions of Blockade Australia can encourage more people to take a more radical position? And do you feel that, you know, the actions of today or the actions that are upcoming this week will perhaps speak to some of those people that might be involved in, for instance, you know, the student strike for climate, or in some of the, you know, the non-government sector work that's occurring now? How do you think you're speaking to those people and perhaps convincing them on a need for a more radical action and radical critique?
What I think that people can take away from seeing this sort of action is the awareness of the power that they hold as individuals and as part of groups. Right? I think the contemporary electoral experience for most people is one of fundamental powerlessness, of an inability to affect change. But I think when people become aware that they can use their bodies, that they can act on the ground to create change in a very material way, that to me is an experience of empowerment. And so that's what we'd like to catalyze. We'd like to continue to build this culture on this continent of people acting directly, not asking permission to avoid climate destruction, but acting to avoid climate destruction.
Hayden, just finally, there is, I guess, an ongoing week of actions, and while many people in WA might not be able to get over at this point and participate, what can people do to support, or can you at least let us know what's coming up and how people can be involved?
Right, so we're going to be seeing the rest of the week of disruption here in Sydney, and of course the best thing that people can do is come down, but secondary to that, we have two fundraisers at the moment. One is helping to replace the many thousands of dollars of equipment that police have stolen in their raid a week ago. And the second is defending people in through the court system who are facing absolutely outrageous and punitive charges that have seemingly been pulled out of the air. So those are the two ways that people can materially help us.
Fantastic. And I just might also mention that an elder, an auntie that a lot of people here in Perth will be familiar with, because she spent a lot of time, her and her son spent a lot of time engaged in the Belia campaign here, was also arrested. So I guess, you know, there's you know, an added incentive, I guess, for people to contribute and support, you know, those that are facing, I guess, significant fines, or, you know, just the laborious task of having to go through the court system. Thanks very much for speaking to us this morning, Hayden, and, you know, all the best with the upcoming actions.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got, and you're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Now, according to the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, at least 13 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces so far this year. Dozens more Palestinian civilians have also been killed, including the revered Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abdul Akleh. Yet, you won't see blazing headlines in the Western press about the need to support the fight against Israeli oppression, let alone announcements of Bushmaster armoured vehicles being sent to the Palestinian resistance. For Palestinian voices are rarely heard, rarely respected. Their messages calling for solidarity are rarely heeded. Indie Media's Alex Wisson sought to make a modest contribution to correcting that gross imbalance by speaking to three members of the Palestinian community of WA Amir, Samia, and AM.
Thanks to the three of you for coming into the studio today. Amir, I wanted to start with you, and then Aman and Samia. I'd also like to get your thoughts on why you think a Palestinian community group is so important for Palestinians in Perth. But first, Amir, explain to the listeners how and why the Palestinian community of Western Australia was first established.
Well, I think, as you know, I think we are all, as individuals, we've been active in the Palestine cause for a long, long time. I think if I might take you back, you were convener of Friends of Palestine Western Australia since 2007 or something like that. And I met you during that year. Then about fast forward 5 years later, I was attending the events that you were organizing, you and the committee, with all the lovely people that we were working with at the time. And then a man called Fadi started coming along. And the idea of organizing a Palestinian organization was on my mind all the time. I think for us it's very important to have the Palestinian voice heard, as well as our great supporters who support the Palestine cause. And I think on two occasions you said to me and Fadi, why don't you two talk to each other? And we were like staring at each other, but very reluctant to do it. But eventually we started chatting, and we had this guy from Gaza, Shamakh, if you remember him, and we got talking, and eventually other people jumped on board. We met each other in cafes, a man called Asim, and then we started in late 2012. We got incorporated 2013. And then other wonderful people like Samia, like Ayman, I knew him on Facebook. Initially, then he came from Gaza, and I met him in real life. That happens very rarely. And the rest is history, and here we are now.
Indeed, and Armin and Samia, your thoughts on the community group. Why is it so important to have an organisation that represents the interests and voices of Palestinians in Western Australia? Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Alex, at the beginning, for having us in this platform and providing us with the space to share our story and our narrative. Meanwhile, our voices and narrative and stories are badly marginalized in the mainstream media, so I really appreciate this opportunity. So the Palestinian community of Western Australia is an extension of the Palestinian global diasporic community, as well as an extension of the Palestinians' growing solidarity movement. I see the Palestinian community as important in providing this platform for Palestinians in Perth to share and tell their stories, whether it's story of the Palestinians who were born here in Australia, or those who were born, who migrated, and or refugees coming to settle in Australia. It is that platform that keep us connected to the struggle overseas, as well as to the keep us connected to our families and friends who are continue to live under a system of occupation, apartheid, and colonialism. Thank you.
And Samia, your involvement in the Palestinian community group, how important do you find, and I guess how you got involved in it yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Alex. And yeah, thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. So yeah, as Amir and Ayman have already touched on, I think the Palestinian community of WA is a really important voice for Palestinian people in WA, and it's also a point of connection for Palestinians to come together and share social events as well. And I think for me, what I find beautiful about PCWA is that it is a non-sectarian organisation that is broadly reflective of the larger Palestinian society, meaning that, you know, Palestinian Christians, Palestinian Muslims are all welcome to join, and there is no emphasis on any particular political leaning. This is how Palestinian society operates generally. So for me, it's a really important point of contact to maintain and strengthen my Palestinian identity within this community where I grew up, but it's also a chance to reach out to others as well.
Now, we'll get back to the question of Palestine and what is happening currently there on the ground shortly, but I wanted to spend a bit of time exploring each of your backgrounds and some of your own personal struggles. Amir, let's start with you again. We don't have time, obviously, to go into your whole life story, which I know is complex and fascinating, if I may say. But you're an exiled Palestinian who has lived in a few different countries, including Iraq. Tell us a little about what that experience was like living through the American invasion and the subsequent journey you and your family undertook to refuge to safety in Perth.
Well, certainly I'm not going to spend 5 hours talking about my life, but I also need to warn that as bad as our experience in Iraq was, it's not 1% of what people in Gaza have suffered. But our story in Iraq is that from the beginning, even what they used to call the good times, we had to carry Palestinian travel documents, which really was not very good, not very welcomed when it comes to applying for visas and stuff. And in the 1990s, 1994 in particular, Saddam Hussein regime issued a Revolution Command Council decision number 23 in 1994, which really made our situation similar to that in Lebanon. It was very difficult for us to make money. Opening a bank account, getting a driving license for a taxi, opening up a doctor's clinic, engineering practice, anything like that was banned for us. And so it drove us very much underground economically. And then came the American invasion, and then suddenly we found a lot of sectarian regimes against us, sectarian militias against us. And they killed 300 of us in total, and made about 70-80% of the Palestinians run away from Iraq. And that includes me. My son was kidnapped because they knew I was a pushover and I had no tribe, no clan protecting me. I was on my own. And so they kidnapped my son and they took a ransom and I got it back. And so after that, I decided to come to go to Canada or Australia, and I came here. So we were very much... the Americans were really fueling this anti-Palestinianism in Iraq. It was pretty bad.
Samir, you've grown up here in Australia, but of course still identify with your Palestinian roots and your Palestinian homeland. What's that experience been like for you, of effectively having a double identity, Australian on the one hand, Palestinian on the other, but also perhaps given the Anglo-dominated monoculture in this country, and dare I say, the continuing systemic racism in this country, were you made to feel like an outsider in this country, or have you had a positive experience of feeling welcomed by the community in Perth? And I guess I hadn't prepared this question, but what's your been experience like in terms of ordinary Australians understanding your identity and your struggles as a Palestinian?
Yeah, look, they're great and important questions, Alex. And yeah, just to add that I identify both as Palestinian and Kurdish Iraqi, although I was born here in Perth, Australia. So yeah, it has been it's been a strange and isolating experience, really, to grow up with this identity in this place. When at a time, I should add, when the Australian general understanding in Australian media has been dominated by a very pro-Western agenda. So I would say that my experience growing up here was isolating. It's not that I personally was not welcomed. I've certainly felt welcomed in this place, but my identity, I would say, was largely misunderstood. Yeah, I would say that the media in Australia that reaches Australia is and has historically been very different to the news on the ground in the Middle East. And so it's been a challenge for me personally to educate the people around me about the reality as I know it, because even, you know, really well-meaning educated people who are pro-human rights and, you know, pro-justice didn't know the Palestinian story until quite recently.
Again, I hadn't prepared this question either, Samir, but I just wanted to follow on from some of what you've just said very, very briefly, that it occurs to me that some of what you've just spoken about, and there's an emotional component to this, is it's probably all the more important that you have a community group where at least you're associating with people who actually understand your struggles and identity. And that, I mean, is that sort of part of it? There's kind of a mutual solidarity there of having that kind of community group.
Certainly, yeah, certainly that's true. And I would say as well that I've got an Australian accent, as you can hear. So, you know, I've grown up in very different circumstances, even to Amir and Ayman sitting here next to me. So the Palestinian identity, I would say, is really diverse, and it is inherently global now. Since 1948, we're literally scattered across the world. And as someone born and raised in Australia, holding a Palestinian identity, you know, I'm one of 6 million people now that have grown up outside the borders of Palestine, and yet we are the modern Palestinian story. So one of the things that has stitched these stories back together, if you like, quite literally, was we ran a beautiful embroidery project a couple of years ago with Palestinian women in Perth called the Palestinian Threads and Stitches, which literally was trying to stitch these stories back together because our identities are so fragmented now, and yet we all share the common threads of Palestinian identity.
That's a really beautiful way of putting it, Samia. And Aman, you of course have had your own particular struggles finding your way to Perth from Gaza, regarded by many as an open prison, blockaded for the best part of two decades by Israel, trade and export severely limited, employment opportunities almost non-existent, even fishing in local waters subject to Israeli attack, and of course a regular pattern of Israeli bombardment on civilian areas, destroying homes, schools, clinics, warehouses, and leaving an entire generation of children, those who survived the assaults, traumatised. It's a big question, really, Armin, and I'm sure, you know, there's a lot involved in some of your struggles and how you got to Australia. But I guess as briefly as possible, what was it like for you in Gaza, and how did you feel about making it to Australia?
It's really very challenging to answer this question, Alex, for so many reasons. As a Palestinian born in the first intifada, has spent the first early years of my life in under occupation as well as under uncertainty and insecurity because resulting from the ongoing occupation, which is still going until the moment I'm addressing your audience here. And then going forward, moving forward as a growing under years of occupation and unrest, and then moving forward to the second Palestinian intifada, and then or second uprising or shake off as they call it. And it's very much shaped by uncertainty, constant land incursion, bombardment, chilling, killing, etc., all form of oppression and insecurity. If I may speak about the last 15 years, for example, of the entire generation, 2.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, continue to be trapped in this tiny enclave, slave, totally deprived from their basic rights to life, to medication, to access of movement. It was extremely hard for us to come to Australia back in 2014, that we had to struggle basically to apply for military permits, and because of the constant closure on Gaza border. I can't deny the fact that it's the moment you think about going home to visit your own family, it's in itself a struggle, okay? Because you know there's no time when you can just get in, or time to get out, and the whole situation is shaped by insecurity. In a personal story, if I may take my younger brother, Muhammad, who is 16 years old. Muhammad basically was born during the years of the Israeli illegal, unlawful blockade in Gaza, has never seen 24 hours of electricity in his entire life, has already survived four Israeli aggressions, you know, where hundreds of Palestinian children got killed. He's one of those who continue to struggle to survive, you know. And we're talking about 800,000 Palestinian children entrapped in Gaza. According to the latest report from Save the Children, an international humanitarian organization, saying 4 out of 5 children in Gaza suffer from anxiety, depression, and uncertainty. And what they just wait for is the next war to erupt. Okay, so you could imagine how this 2 million, 2.5 million trapped in this highly populated, one of the world densely populated, described as the open air prison, continue to be subjected, you know, Israeli government control every aspect of our life. Every aspect, you know, from right to health to movement to even decide if you hope, you know, our life is shaped by insecurity and, uncertainty by the Israeli occupation authorities.
Thank you, Armin. And very powerful set of life lessons there for any listeners out there who aren't familiar with the Palestinian experience in Gaza.
You're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Indie Media's Alex Wisson is speaking to Amir Samia and I am from the Palestinian community of WA. And you're listening to RTRFM 92.1.
Coming back now to the more general experience of Palestinians, and Armin, you've already touched on quite a bit of it, but we know, and it's a constant source of frustration for Palestinians and supporters of Palestinians, that the way the conflict is shaped by the mainstream media is less than ideal, to put it mildly. And hopefully people listening to this broadcast who perhaps aren't familiar with the Palestinian struggle have learned something already from this interview. As I say, the mainstream media casts the conflict as an intractable one. There's often a refrain that it's a religious-based conflict and that somehow it's a conflict that's far too complicated for ordinary people to understand. Again, it's quite a big question to ask the three of you. Samir, if I could come back to you. I mean, what in your view, perhaps not in your personal view, because I guess it's not a question of an opinion really, but how would you summarise what this conflict is about? Or what would you say to people who say, oh no, this is impossible to resolve, it's religious-based conflict, et cetera?
Sure, look, these are really important questions again. And I guess if I can say anything very clearly, the Palestinian struggle has never been a religious conflict. There are Palestinian Muslims, Palestinian Christians who have been equally impacted by the fact that they are Palestinians. And my father, for example, was exiled in 1948 as a young man from Palestine. And he's never been allowed to return home. And this is the reason that I live in Australia. This is the reason that I am not allowed to live on that land. As a Palestinian Christian woman, it's irrelevant whether I'm Christian or Muslim. And yet the Western media has tried to portray this, unfortunately, as a Jewish versus Muslim war, and nothing could be further from the truth. Every Palestinian knows this is a struggle for our rights to return to our land. It's pure and simple. I think it does get misconstrued a lot as it being too complex for people to understand, which unfortunately means that people are encouraged to switch off from it. But I think I would say that it's really just probably just one step further in complexity than any other colonial project, meaning that for the Palestinians, we have experienced displacement in the way that any other settler colonial regime has displaced its indigenous population. And the Palestinian desire and right, inalienable right to return to our homeland, is shared by any other indigenous group that has been displaced through war or colonization. So the settler colonial state of Israel and the Zionist project that has created it has been born out of the Jewish struggle and Jewish persecution across Europe. So, you know, that's the extra layer of complexity that most people, I think, struggle to contend with. But the displacement of the Jewish diaspora from Europe then created a Jewish state in historic Palestine, which unfortunately has... So the Palestinian refugee crisis is exactly as old as the state of Israel. So since 1948, around 80% of the Palestinian population has been displaced from their ancestral homes, and most of them have not been allowed to return.
I think that's an excellent summary, Samia. And you know, with all of these questions, we could talk at much greater length. We'll have to wrap it up soon. But specifically returning to the Palestinian community of Western Australia, and I'll come back to you for this question, Amar, as to what its goals and objectives are. We've already spoken about it a little as a community group, and there's a mutual support element to it for the membership. But does it also have a set of wider objectives or political objectives, Amar?
If you don't mind, I'll just read you out quickly some of the objectives. Well, we want to create social relationships among our Palestinians in Perth in Western Australia. We want to integrate our people into the wider Australian society, and while maintaining our own unique heritage and culture and sense of belonging and values, we want to some of the things we really haven't been doing very much. Improve the welfare of our own people and try to help them with government and non-government organizations. We wish we could do a bit more than that on this perspective, but it's all about finding time and human resources. And we want to engage our people into social and cultural and sport activities. And we've done quite a lot of that, actually. And we would like to support our people in politically as well, such as trying to talk about our cause, trying to tell people about our story, our history, about our displacement, about our becoming refugees, and to cultivate relationships with people in the homeland. We haven't done very much on that as well. I wish we could do that, like we link up with our people in Gaza, in the West Bank, and to act as consultative to politicians and NGOs and other groups. We've tried doing that, and we'll keep on trying to do that. We're not always effective, but we do our best. And to spread knowledge about our identity and culture and history. So yes, there is. Where there's Palestinians, there's politics. It's unavoidable, but we're hoping that the PCWA isn't just about that. I think from the Palestinian crowd that we do social activities as well.
And it's worth stressing again, I guess, Amar, as Samia made the point, that it's very much a non-sectarian group. All Palestinian Australians welcome. It doesn't have a particular political line. It's not allied with Fatah or Hamas or any particular group. It's non-sectarian. It's it's a genuine community group, isn't it, for all Palestinians?
Although there aren't any written rules about that, but of course, I mean, I think it's a given that we don't allow any sectarianism. That's a big no-no. And we don't identify people by Christian or Muslim anyway. We're just Palestinians. And certainly on the political side, you're entitled to your views, but we will not allow people to create factions inside, like a Fatah or PFLP or anything else.
Thanks very much for that, Amar. We'll have to wrap up shortly, guys. And I'll throw this question open to the three of you, so whoever gets the microphone first, I guess. But it's a serious question, though, which is sort of a two-part question, which is what message would you have to Palestinian Australians out there who want to get involved with the community association? Because it strikes me there's a lot more Palestinians living in Perth than are involved in the community group. So I'm sure you would welcome new members and new people who want to get involved. So what your message might be to Palestinian Australians listening to this broadcast? And then the second part of the question is what message you would have to non-Palestinians listening who have maybe learnt from this or maybe angry about what's happening in Palestine, and how they can get involved in solidarity work, or how they can learn more. So Armin, I guess what would you say to Palestinians or maybe non-Palestinians listening?
I would like them to join this struggle, because this struggle is not only for Palestinians. The question of Palestine is not only for Palestinians. It's for every single person who fights for humanity, justice, equality for everyone. Palestinians in Palestine continue to suffer because of we always quest freedom, justice, equality, and equality. And this is not something that we are attaining at the moment in Palestine. So this is a call for all the free people across the world, Palestinian and non-Palestinians, to join the Palestinian struggle, which is growing in a daily basis. And we see this is growing because of the global solidarity movement that we are a part of here. People joining, please speak up for justice, speak up for Palestinians, because if we don't speak, if we continue to be silent, we are complicit in sustaining this system of oppression and occupation and apartheid in Palestine. There are so many Palestinians continue to die as I'm talking to you here silently, so it's really important for us to continue organize conferences, meetups, you know, talk to your local politicians, ask about their stance on Palestine, you know, on occupation, you know, occupation that is disrespect every aspect of our life, that is denied our right to exist as a human being, occupation that is against the international law, against the Geneva Convention, against any convention that the Australian government has signed, basically, to the United Nations, for example. So it's really important for us to continue, organize, be active in this solidarity group. University, we have, you know, Palestinian Solidarity student group within the universities. Try to join them. We need the young generation to speak up and change this misleading narrative that we have spoke about it earlier on, that, you know, it's a complex story. There's no complicity about this. It's not a complex. It's about 6 million Palestinians who continue to be trapped under occupation, okay, that is funded by major world government, by the US, you know, for example, that supplies Israel with $3 billion military assistance every single year, okay? So this is not a complex or conflict or something. It's about an entire nation being their life being controlled by an occupying power. Occupation is wrong, and it should come to an end, and I'm sure it's going to come to an end.
Thanks for that, Armin. And just finally, to finish off with you, Arma, in terms of how people can get involved in the Palestinian community of WA, just your final thoughts.
Well, I mean, firstly, if you could just give us your email account, we'll put you on a mailing list. That's one way. If you want to like our Facebook page, Palestinian Community in Western Australia, that's another way. If you'd like to attend our activities and meet up with us, or if you like to just write to the email account, palcomwa, if you like, @gmail.com. It's quite simple. And any way you want to communicate with us, you're welcome. And thank you very much.
That was Palestinian Community of WA members Amir, Say, Ma, and I am speaking to Indie Media's Alex Wisson. And that's it for this week's edition of the Indie Media Show. We'll be back next week from 11 a.m. Keep it locked, though, as Rhiannon Todd-Hunter is going to take you out to lunch. All your new music needs for your Monday afternoon. If you enjoyed the program and you'd like to get in touch, you can always do that through the RTRFM offices, or you can hit us up on the corporate social media. This show is also available as a podcast, so you can do that if you like, if you want to re-listen to it. Or you can check out our individual interviews on our SoundCloud.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?